The dairy, smokehouse, and wash house were moved here, alongside the kitchen, ice cellar, storerooms, carriage bays, and a few slave quarters. As he built and farmed, he fought bouts with rheumatism, which kept him in incessant torment, yet found joy in his family. Writing of grandson Thomas Jefferson Randolph, Patsy's son, in early 1795, he said, "Jefferson is very robust. His hands are constantly like lumps of ice, yet he will not warm them. He has not worn his shoes an hour this winter. If put on him, he takes them off immediately and uses one to carry his nuts, etc. in. Within these 2 days, we have put both him and Anne into moccasins, which, being made of the soft leather, fitting well and lacing up, they have never been able to take them off." He loved his guns and his horses. He loved to hunt and to fish. His mounts tended to have noble names, from Alley Croker, Jefferson's first known horse, to Gustavus, to Cucullin, to the General, to Alfred, Caractacus, Ethelinda, Silvertail, Ora Moor, Peggy Woffington, Zanga, Polly Peachum, and the carriage horses Romulus and Remus. There was also a Raleigh, a Tarquin, a Castor, a Diomede, a Brimo, a Wellington, a Tecumseh, a Peacemaker, and the Eagle, Jefferson's last horse, which was purchased in 1820. Jefferson liked to fish at home and while away. He had a favorite spot below the old dam on the Rivanna. He enjoyed outings on the Schuylkill River when he was in Philadelphia, and he relished a day at Lake George in the Adirondacks on his trip through the north with James Madison in 1791. An abundance of speckled trout, salmon trout, bass, and other fish with which it is stored have added to our other amusements the sport of taking them, Jefferson had written Patsy. He had been as unhappy with Lake Champlain as he had been happy with Lake George, noting that the larger Champlain was a far less pleasant water. It is muddy, turbulent, and yields little game. All things Jefferson disliked in fishing, as in life. He kept guns and traveled armed. He once left behind a gun locked in a box at the inn at Orange Courthouse, and had to write the innkeeper to track it down. To Jefferson, hunting was the best form of exercise. He often recommended it, though riding was the great solace and activity of his later years. Jefferson hunted squirrels and partridges, recalled Isaac Granger Jefferson. "Old master wouldn't shoot partridges settin'." A fair-minded sportsman, Jefferson would scare up partridges or rabbits before firing. He would also drive hunters away from Monticello's deer park. Jefferson's gun collection included a 2-shot double barrel and a set of Turkish pistols with 20-inch barrels so well made that I never missed a squirrel at 30 yards with them. He was a man of his time on the question of guns, writing in 1822 that every American who wishes to protect his farm from the ravages of quadrupeds and his country from those of biped invaders should be a gunman, adding, "I'm a great friend to the manly and healthy exercises of the gun." Led by James Madison, correspondence kept Jefferson current on politics and foreign affairs. Animosity between Federalists and Republicans was a constant theme. Personalities which lessen the pleasures of society, or prevent their being sought, have occurred in private and at tables, Tench Cox, an American economist who served as Hamilton's Assistant Secretary of the Treasury, wrote from Philadelphia. The next week, James Monroe detailed the fight over resolutions connected to Jefferson's Commerce Report. The Senate's vote to expel Albert Gallatin, a Pennsylvania Republican, on grounds that when elected he had not been a citizen of the United States for the requisite 9 years. A battle over a congressional call to see Gouverneur Morris's correspondence. An Indian treaty. And, of course, the disastrous mission of Edmund Charles Genet. Jefferson was living in relative isolation, but details of the world were in constant supply. In March 1794, Federalist Congressman Theodore Sedgwick of Massachusetts had introduced legislation to create a new army of 15,000 men and give the president extraordinary powers to control sea traffic. The argument, Monroe told Jefferson, was founded upon the idea of providing for our defense against invasion, and the probability of such an event, considering the unfriendly conduct of Great Britain towards us for some time past. However concerned the Republicans were about Great Britain, They were also skeptical of the Federalist plan, fearing that this was but a first step toward creating an army that might be raised to defend America, but could end up being used to undermine the Constitution in a time of crisis. Republics tended to fall to military dictatorships, and military dictators needed a military. A change so extraordinary must have a serious object in view, Monroe wrote Jefferson. They are to be raised in no given quarter, and although they may be deemed a kind of minutemen in respect to their situation, except in time of war, yet in every other respect, they will be regulars. The Order of Cincinnati will be placed in the command of it. The Republicans struck where they could. As part of a naturalization bill, William Branch Giles proposed requiring new American citizens to renounce any hereditary titles they held in other countries, thus, the Jeffersonians hoped, reducing the chance of emigrant aristocrats creating an old-world ethos in America. In reaction, the Federalist Congressman Samuel Dexter of Massachusetts suggested that slaveholding immigrants disclose their human property. "You want to hold us up to the public as aristocrats," said Dexter. "I, as a retaliation, will hold you up to the same public as dealers in slaves." Giles' amendment passed. Dexter's failed. Both efforts illuminated the emotional issues shaping American politics. Republican fear of the prospect of hereditary power and the Federalist anxiety about the strength of slaveholders. The accumulation of power in the hands of Federalists was a running source of worry to Jefferson and his comrades. As Congress gathered in the late autumn of 1794, lawmakers who attended Washington's delivery of his annual message heard the president's account of the Whiskey Rebellion and an unapologetic attack on the Democratic-Republican societies. The Whiskey Rebellion in the West was rooted in farmers' fury over Hamilton's excise taxes. Episode built upon episode until there were attacks on Bower Hill, the home of General John Neville, a federal tax inspector. A leader of the protesters, James McFarlane, was shot and killed. A large government force under both Hamilton and Light Horse Harry Lee was mustered and dispatched to western Pennsylvania. Washington himself rode out with the troops for a time. Though the rebellion collapsed, the violence was connected, in Washington's mind, with the political agitation of the Democratic-Republican societies, and he attacked both the Whiskey Rebellion and the societies in 1794. Jefferson took a sage tone with William Branch Giles in mid-December. "The attempt which has been made to restrain the liberty of our citizens meeting together, interchanging sentiments on what subjects they please, and stating these sentiments in the public papers, has come upon us a full century earlier than I expected." Taking the view that the administration was trying not only to quell the Pennsylvania uprising, but to curtail peaceable freedom of assembly, Jefferson made himself plain to Madison. "The denunciation of the Democratic societies is one of the extraordinary acts of boldness of which we have seen so many from the faction of monocrats." And what did the Whiskey Rebellion amount to, really? To Jefferson, it was hardly worth noting. "There was, indeed, a meeting to consult about a separation," he wrote Madison in December 1794. "But to consult on a question does not amount to a determination of that question in the affirmative, still less to the acting on such a determination." Drama, Jefferson knew, was one of the prices one paid for democracy. Jefferson's love of control was evident when he was at home. He was precise and demanding about his horses. When he was younger and his mount was brought to him, he would use a white cambric handkerchief to brush the horse's shoulders. If there were dust, the horse was returned to the stables. Only the perfect would suffice. His horses were sources of immense pleasure, but he also disliked animals with wills of their own, and his mask of equanimity could slip occasionally when it came to his horses. The only impatience of temper he ever exhibited was with his horse, which he subdued to his will by a fearless application of the whip on the slightest manifestation of restiveness, said a grandson. His family preserved two other stories about significant displays of anger. Both outbursts were the result of being contradicted. The first came when Jefferson ordered a slave to fetch a carriage horse for an errand. Jupiter, the slave who was in charge of those horses, refused not once but twice. "Tell Jupiter to come to me at once," Jefferson said, furious that his orders had been thwarted. The rebuke that Jupiter endured, according to the family story, was no ordinary one. It was epic, delivered by Jefferson in tones and with a look which neither he nor the terrified bystanders ever forgot. Jefferson's commands were not to be challenged or questioned. Ever. A second hour of fury that lived on in the family's history unfolded on a river crossing. Two ferrymen had been fighting between themselves when they took Jefferson and his daughter Patsy aboard for the passage. The peace did not last long, and soon the two men were about to become violent. According to the story, Jefferson, his eyes flashing, then snatched up an oar, and in a voice which rung out above the angry tones of the men, flourished it over their heads. Weapon in hand, Jefferson issued an unmistakable command, "Row for your lives, or I will knock you both overboard." There, in the midst of the waters, his safety and that of his daughter in danger from the quarrels of other men, Jefferson seized control and forced his will on others. And they did row for their lives, nor, I imagine, did they soon forget the fiery looks and excited appearance of that tall, weird-like-looking figure brandishing the heavy oar over their offending heads, his granddaughter wrote. He let his true emotions show when something he loved, in this case his daughter, was in danger. He loved his country, too, and was growing ever more convinced that it, too, was in peril. If you visit me as a farmer, it must be as a condisciple, for I am but a learner, an eager one indeed, but yet desperate, being too old now to learn a new art. Jefferson wrote William Branch Giles. He liked being with old friends. Come, then, and let us take our soup and wine together every day and talk over the stories of our youth and the tales of other times, he wrote one. Madison struck at this idyll. You ought to be preparing yourself to hear truths which no inflexibility will be able to withstand, Madison wrote to Jefferson in March 1795. For Madison, the central truth was this. Thomas Jefferson was destined to seek the presidency of the United States. Jefferson admitted that the subject had been on his mind. Compelled, he said, by his enemies' continual insinuations in the public papers that he was contending to succeed Washington, Jefferson told Madison that he had felt my own quiet required that I should face it and examine it. His decision, he wrote in April 1795, was no. He would not stand for the office. The little spice of ambition which I had in my younger days has long since evaporated, and I set still less store by a posthumous than a present name. That was not strictly true, but Jefferson liked to tell himself it was. Public men were not to be seen as anxious for office or place, and Jefferson frequently denied his self-evident drive to shape the era in which he lived. In this springtime of 1795, though, there may have been more conviction behind his rote protestations than usual. He had been sick with rheumatism, consumed with farming and financial matters long overlooked, delighted by grandchildren, and presumably enjoying for the first extended period of time in 4 years his liaison with Sally Hemings. He was not lying when he wrote Madison and other friends of his permanent retirement. He was finding rest and refuge at Monticello. What he himself may not have fully realized was how intimately, how naturally and unthinkingly, he remained connected to politics. By now, nearly a quarter century since his first election to the House of Burgesses, the life of the nation was as much an element of his own life as science or music or Monticello. He could no more unwind himself from the affairs of the Republic than he could have chosen to cease being interested in science or books. He needed the world of politics and of consequence. It was crucial to his health and to his sense of self and well-being. I am convinced our own happiness requires that we should continue to mix with the world and to keep pace with it as it goes, and that every person who retires from free communication with it is severely punished afterwards by the state of mind into which they get, and which can only be prevented by feeding our sociable principles. Jefferson wrote to Polly after he became president. I can speak from experience on this subject. From 1793 to 1797 I remained closely at home, saw none but those who came there, and at length became very sensible of the ill effect it had upon my own mind, and of its direct and irresistible tendency to render me unfit for society, and uneasy when necessarily engaged in it. I felt enough of the effect of withdrawing from the world then to see that it led to an antisocial and misanthropic state of mind, which severely punishes him who gives into it, and it will be a lesson I shall never forget as to myself. The articulation of his beliefs, the holding of office, the championing of things republican against things monarchical. Politics was not only what Thomas Jefferson practiced. It was part of who he was, even if he himself sometimes failed to see it. In June 1795, he asked the Philadelphia editor, Benjamin Franklin Bache, to make me up a set of your papers for the year 1794. Madison sent along what he called a fugitive publication of his own, a pamphlet entitled Political Observations. William Branch Giles announced he was going to see Jefferson before I go to winter quarters, the Congress. In the fall, Aaron Burr of New York called at Monticello, leading to Federalist charges that the two men had planned and approved the Republican agenda in the ensuing Congress. It had been a brief visit on Jefferson's mountaintop, only a single day. However few the hours they spent together this autumn, though, Jefferson and Burr were to be intimately linked for the next dozen years, first as allies, then as foes. Born in Newark, New Jersey, in 1756, Aaron Burr was the grandson of Jonathan Edwards, the theologian, preacher, and president of the College of New Jersey, later Princeton. Burr's father, the Reverend Aaron Burr Sr., married Edwards's daughter, Elizabeth, and himself became president of the college, where his son was educated. Handsome, charming, adventurous, and ambitious, the younger Aaron Burr was a revolutionary officer, a lawyer, and one of the most fascinating politicians of the age. He married the widow of a British officer, Theodosia Prevost, and they had a beautiful daughter, also named Theodosia. Burr was an architect of Republican politics in New York, rising through the ranks from the state assembly to become the state attorney general, and in 1791, U.S. Senator. Mastering the mechanics of election, Burr was to prove invaluable to the Jeffersonian cause. Until, in Jefferson's view, the two men's causes came into conflict in the presidential election of 1800. But that still lay in the future. For now, the issue confronting politicians of every sort, and indeed the country, was the possibility of war with Britain. John Jay's mission to London had not produced the result Jefferson had hoped. Far from it. The treaty, which President Washington received on Saturday, March 7, 1795, appeared to concede too much to London, essentially codifying the economic ties between the two nations that Hamilton had been nurturing for years. The political reaction was swift and, for Washington, brutal. Angry crowds burned Jay in effigy. There was even talk of impeaching Washington. Jefferson despised the treaty as a Hamiltonian document, and much of the country joined him. From north to south, this monument of folly or venality is universally execrated, Jefferson told Thomas Mann Randolph in August 1795. Even mid-August floods could not replace the Jay Treaty as the overriding topic of the day. So general a burst of dissatisfaction never before appeared against any transaction, said Jefferson. Worried that Hamilton, really a colossus to the anti-Republican Party, Jefferson called him, might somehow win the war for public opinion, Jefferson urged Madison to write against the treaty, fretting about the quietism into which the people naturally fall after first sensations are over. As Jefferson read the treaty, he saw that Hamilton had successfully managed to legislate through Jay's diplomacy. A bolder party stroke was never struck, Jefferson told Madison, for it certainly is an attempt of a party which finds they have lost their majority in one branch of the legislature to make a law by the aid of the other branch and the executive, under color of a treaty, which shall bind up the hands of the adverse branch from ever restraining the commerce of their patron nation. The treaty was, nevertheless, narrowly ratified. Washington believed, as did a bare two-thirds majority of the Senate, that the pact was preferable to going to war. The agreement with London faced an unusual additional obstacle. The House needed to approve funding for some elements of the treaty. Washington, under attack as a supercilious tyrant and a ruler who tramples on the laws and constitution, went to the House chamber in December 1795 to deliver his annual message. He had enjoyed more hospitable greetings. Never, till a few months preceding this session, had the tongue of the most factious slander dared to make a public attack on his character, wrote William Cobbett, the pamphleteer who wrote under the name Peter Porcupine. This was the first time he had ever entered the walls of Congress without a full assurance of meeting a welcome from every heart. Now he was looking out over a crowd of members who were ready to thwart his measures and present him the cup of humiliation filled to the brim. Yet the House joined the Senate in grudgingly voting to support the treaty. Finally, on Friday, May 6, 1796, Washington signed the Jay Treaty. The New England states have been ready to rise in mass against the House of Representatives, Madison wrote Jefferson 3 days after Washington signed the documents. Such have been the exertions and influence of aristocracy, Anglicism, and mercantilism in that quarter that republicanism is perfectly overwhelmed. The day belonged to the Federalists. The price of this diplomatic and political victory, however, was high, for the approval of the Jay Treaty by the Federalists gave the nascent Republicans a palpable and energizing sense of purpose. They knew where to turn, and to whom. Jefferson was already thinking about the politics of the hour in practical terms, turning a scientific eye to the world around him. In notes he drafted sometime after mid-October 1795, he sketched out his sense of the state of play. Jefferson wrote, "Two parties, then, do exist within the U.S. They embrace, respectively, the following descriptions of persons. The anti-Republicans consist of, 1, the old refugees and Tories. 2, British merchants residing among us and composing the main body of our merchants. 3, American merchants trading on British capital, another great portion. 4, speculators and holders in the banks and public funds. 5, officers of the federal government with some exceptions. 6, office hunters, willing to give up principles for places, a numerous and noisy tribe. 7, nervous persons, whose languid fibers have more analogy with a passive than active state of things. The Republican part of our Union comprehends, 1, the entire body of landholders throughout the United States. 2, the body of laborers, not being landholders, whether in husbandry or the arts. The latter is to the aggregate of the former probably as 500 to 1, but their wealth is not as disproportionate, though it is also greatly superior, and is in truth the foundation of that of their antagonists. Trifling as are the numbers of the anti-Republican party, there are circumstances which give them an appearance of strength and numbers. They all live in cities, together, and can act in a body readily and at all times. They give chief employment to the newspapers, and therefore have most of them under their command. The agricultural interest is dispersed over a great extent of country, have little means of intercommunication with each other, and feeling their own strength and will, are conscious that a single exertion of these will at any time crush the machinations against their government. Jefferson's assessment of the foe mixed fear and pride. He worried about the Federalists, but believed the Republicans capable of victory whenever they chose to bestir themselves. The anxiety produced by the enemy fueled the politician's sense of urgency. The faith in the virtues of his own cause gave him the power to endure the most hopeless and despairing of moments. On the day after Christmas, 1795, Jefferson wrote Bache to subscribe to his newspaper, The Aurora, as well as to other editors in Philadelphia and Richmond to begin receiving their papers. Though he had hardly left the arena, he was now unmistakably back in it. Jefferson had never doubted the power of the presidency. From his first reading of the draft constitution while in France, he sensed that the office could become the center of action for the whole government. Experience had proved his instincts right. Reflecting on Washington's Jay Treaty victory, Jefferson wrote Monroe, "You will have seen that one man outweighs them all in influence over the people who have supported his judgment against their own and that of their representatives. Republicanism must lie on its oars, resign the vessel to its pilot, and themselves to the course he thinks best for them." Given the season of these remarks, the middle of June 1796, almost 6 months to the day before the Electoral College was to meet to choose a successor to Washington, Jefferson was thinking about how different America's prospects would be if the pilot of the vessel were a Republican, and, more to the point, whether he himself should be that pilot. Decorous silence on the explicit question of a candidacy for the office was to be maintained, but Jefferson was about to face the most momentous decision of his public life since he chose country over king in the hurly-burly of the Revolution. Would he allow his name to go forward as a candidate for President of the United States, after all? First, he wanted to clear up some worrisome business with Washington himself. Always sensitive about the opinions of others, and particularly anxious for Washington to think well of him, Jefferson had read a report in the June 9, 1796 Aurora that drew on a confidential document Washington had given to members of his cabinet during the neutrality debates. Jefferson was determined to convince Washington that he, at least, had not betrayed the president's trust. Swearing on everything sacred and honorable, Jefferson promised Washington on June 19th that the document had never been from under my own lock and key. Jefferson was concerned about what Washington thought of him in these early summer weeks of 1796, for he knew that the president was hearing rumors that Jefferson had been privately critical of, even condescending toward, his old chief. Worried about such impressions, Jefferson wrote Washington warning that some people may try to sow tares between you and me by presenting Jefferson as still engaged in the bustle of politics and in turbulence and intrigue against the government. When Washington replied in July 1796, he absolved Jefferson of responsibility for the Aurora matter, but used the occasion to address Jefferson's views of the administration. "As you have mentioned the subject yourself," said Washington, "it would not be frank, candid, or friendly to conceal that your conduct has been represented as derogating from that opinion I had conceived you entertained of me." The Federalists were busy maneuvering for the approaching presidential election. Their tactics included overtures to Jefferson nemesis Patrick Henry to stand for president. Henry was uninterested, but the latter suggestion, which, if adopted, would have divided Virginia, underscored the Federalists' conviction that Jefferson was likely to be their main foe. From the West, the legislator William Cock, a native Virginian, now among the leading men of Tennessee, made himself plain to Jefferson in August 1796. It was Cock's happy duty, he wrote, "to inform you that the people of this state, of every description, express a wish that you should be the next President of the United States, and Mr. Burr, Vice President." Jefferson's reply was at once clear and equivocal. "I have not the arrogance to say I would refuse the honorable office you mentioned to me, but I can say with truth that I would rather be thought worthy of it than to be appointed to it," he wrote Cock, "for well I know that no man will ever bring out of that office the reputation which carries him into it." Chapter 28. To the Vice Presidency. There is a debt of service due from every man to his country, proportioned to the bounties which nature and fortune have measured to him. Thomas Jefferson. You and I have formerly seen warm debates and high political passions, but gentlemen of different politics would then speak to each other. It is not so now. Men who have been intimate all their lives cross the streets to avoid meeting and turn their heads another way, lest they should be obliged to touch their hat. Thomas Jefferson to Edward Rutledge. The publication of Washington's farewell address on Monday, September 19, 1796, set off America's first contested presidential election. The Washington announcement was, Massachusetts Congressman Fisher Ames said, "a signal like dropping a hat for the party racers to start." Presidential elections in the first decades of the Republic were odd affairs. Candidates did not campaign. They allowed, obliquely or through friends and allies, that they were available to be elected. Networks of the like-minded put together a ticket for president and vice president. In most states, individual electors let it be known that a vote for them would be a vote for their favorites for both offices. Until the ratification of the 12th Amendment in 1804, there was no distinction between the two offices in the Electoral College. The second-place finisher became vice president. However different in form presidential contests were, one feature has been constant from the beginning. They have been rife with attacks and counterattacks. It took just 10 days from the publication of Washington's farewell for Jefferson's enemies to strike against him, and strike hard. On Thursday, September 29, 1796, the Columbian Mirror and Alexandria Gazette published a statement from Charles Sims, a Federalist lawyer close to President Washington. Sims was campaigning to become a presidential elector for John Adams from Prince William, Stafford, and Fairfax counties in Virginia. He took Jefferson on directly in his late September broadside. Jefferson, Sims charged, was not fit for high office, for he had fled the wartime governorship at the moment of an invasion of the enemy, by which great confusion, loss, and distress accrued to the state in the destruction of public records. Such a man was too weak to be president, Sims said, for no one can know how soon or from whence a storm may come. Jefferson was, in other words, a coward, driven by vanity. Adams, on the other hand, was a statesman who could be counted on to stay the course set by George Washington. The Jeffersonians reacted with force. John Taylor of Caroline, a pro-Jefferson Virginian, drafted a reply for publication. It made the case that Governor Jefferson had not failed in his duty, telling again the story of the invasion of 1781. Most important, in what was to become a perennially useful political theme, the Republicans argued that the contest of the hour was about the present, not the past. It was, they said, about the conflict between Republican and monarchical visions of American government. Taylor illustrated his point by describing a 1794 conversation with Vice President Adams and New Hampshire Senator John Langdon, in which Adams allegedly said that no government could long exist, or that no people could be happy, without an hereditary first magistrate and an hereditary senate, or a senate for life. Campaign literature read, "Thomas Jefferson is a firm Republican. John Adams is an avowed monarchist." After the Jay Treaty, the next president faced the rising prospect of war with France, a possibility that imbued the election with an even greater sense of urgency than it already had. Enduring a late autumn cold spell at Monticello, the temperature had dropped to 12 degrees, freezing the ink in its well on his desk. Jefferson awaited news of the 1796 election results. Given the tasks facing the next president, he said the vice presidency might be preferable to winning the presidency itself. "Few will believe the true dispositions of my mind on that subject," Jefferson wrote. "It is not the less true, however, that I do sincerely wish to be the second on that vote, rather than the first." Hamilton, who opposed both Adams and Jefferson, was a complicating factor. He devised a fascinating strategy to deny his two rivals the presidency by urging Federalist electors in South Carolina to cast ballots for Adams' choice for vice president, native son Thomas Pinckney, for president, rather than vice president. Hamilton's motive? Madison wrote to Jefferson that Hamilton believed Adams too headstrong to be a fit puppet for the intriguers behind the screen. One sign that Jefferson was more invested in a personal victory than his formulaic protestations to the contrary lies in a note Madison wrote him on Saturday, December 10, 1796. "You must reconcile yourself to the secondary as well as the primary station, if that should be your lot," Madison told Jefferson. The emphasis on must is Madison's, suggesting that Jefferson's closest political friend and counselor knew the presidential candidate to be anxious for the top post. Madison was also preparing his friend for the possibility that the Hamiltonian maneuvering could throw the election into the House of Representatives if Adams and Jefferson ended up in a tie in the vote. Jefferson knew that a subsequent numerical deadlock in the House was also possible, a difficulty from which the Constitution has provided no issue, he wrote Madison. Should he and Adams find themselves in such a situation, Jefferson authorized Madison fully to solicit on my behalf that Mr. Adams may be preferred. He has always been my senior from the commencement of our public life, and the expression of the public will being equal, this circumstance ought to give him the preference. As the returns reached Philadelphia, Pinckney faded to third, and Madison worried that Jefferson had been so set on becoming president that he might refuse the second spot. Appealing first to Jefferson's concern for reputation, Madison wrote that it is expected that, as you had made up your mind to obey the call of your country, you will let it decide on the particular place where your services are to be rendered. Moreover, having a Republican influence in close proximity to the president could be important, even critical. There is reason to believe also that your neighborhood to Adams may have a valuable effect on his counsels, particularly in relation to our external system, Madison wrote. On Wednesday, February 8, 1797, the electoral votes were tallied. Adams won, barely, by a margin of 71 to Jefferson's 68. Pinckney carried 59. The Federalists fretted about Jefferson's winning the vice presidency. One anti-Jeffersonian clergyman was reported to have prayed, "O Lord, wilt thou bestow upon the vice president a double portion of thy grace, for thou knowest he needs it." Adams was thrilled to become president. As he had written Abigail, he believed deeply in the sense, spirit, and resources of this country, which few other men in the world know so well or have so long tried and found solid. Despite the second place finish, Jefferson found the results flattering. "I value the late vote highly," he said, "but it is only as the index of the place I hold in the esteem of my fellow citizens." Jefferson spent the cold weeks after the election ruminating on politics. "I knew it was impossible Mr. Adams should lose a vote north of the Delaware, and that the free and moral agency of the South would furnish him an abundant supplement," he wrote. "On principles of public respect, I should not have refused the presidency, but I protest before my God that I shall, from the bottom of my heart, rejoice at escaping." He took a wry, knowing tone. The honeymoon would be as short in that case as in any other, and its moments of ecstasy would be ransomed by years of torment and hatred. The vice presidency was the better place at this hour. "This is certainly not a moment to covet the helm," Jefferson said. Whispers of possible secession to form a confederacy of northern states appeared in the Connecticut Current in November and December 1796. Whispers that hinted at a larger source of tension. At issue was the advantage Jefferson and his fellow Southerners had in national elections because of the three-fifths clause, the constitutional provision that counted a slave as three-fifths of a person to establish the number of congressmen and presidential electors allocated to each state. When Jefferson went on to win the presidency 4 years later, his Federalist critics would disparage him as the Negro president, because of his dependence on the three-fifths clause. The battles over slavery were thus rooted not only in the debate over the morality of abolition, but in the practical political reality that every additional slave state, ironically and tragically, increased the power of white office seekers from those states. Jefferson found it preferable, and more comfortable, to strike grand notes on secession rather than engage his adversaries on the stark realities of the mathematics of power. "We shall never give up our Union, the last anchor of our hope, and that alone which is to prevent this heavenly country from becoming an arena of gladiators," he told Elbridge Gerry. In the last days of the 1796 election, Jefferson had drafted a kind letter to Adams. After the usual disclaimers, "I have no ambition to govern men," Jefferson wrote that the presidency was a painful and thankless office. "Should Adams be able to shun for us this war by which our agriculture, commerce, and credit will be destroyed, then the glory will be all your own, and that your administration may be filled with glory and happiness to yourself and advantage to us is the sincere wish of one who, though in the course of our voyage through life various little incidents have happened or been contrived to separate us, retains still for you the solid esteem of the moments when we were working for our independence. On New Year's Day, 1797, Jefferson sent Madison a draft of the letter to Adams. I can particularly have no feelings which would revolt at a secondary position to Mr. Adams, Jefferson wrote. I am his junior in life, was his junior in Congress, his junior in the diplomatic line, his junior lately in our civil government. Nevertheless, he asked Madison whether he should send Adams the letter. Madison replied with a 6-point case against it. The key ones? Since things were currently cordial between the two men, it deserves to be considered whether the idea of bettering it is not outweighed by the possibility of changing it for the worse. Another, may not what is said of the sublime delights of riding the storm, etc., be misconstrued into a reflection on those who have no distaste to the helm at the present crisis? You know the temper of Mr. Adams better than I do, but I have always conceived it to be a rather ticklish one. Another, the tenderness due to the zealous and active promoters of your election makes it doubtful whether their anxieties and exertions ought to be depreciated by anything implying the unreasonableness of them. I know that some individuals who have deeply committed themselves and probably incurred the political enmity, at least of the president-elect, are already sore on this head. And finally, considering the probability that Mr. Adams's course of administration may force an opposition to it from the Republican quarter, there may be real embarrassments from giving written possession to him of the degree of compliment and confidence which your personal delicacy and friendship have suggested. Jefferson was grateful for the counsel. He would not mail the letter. Jefferson reached Philadelphia on Thursday, March 2, 1797. Without delay, he called on the president-elect. Adams, who lodged at Francis's on 4th Street, repaid the courtesy the next morning, visiting Jefferson in his temporary quarters. Closing the door behind him, the president-elect said he was glad Jefferson was alone. The two had much to talk about. Adams spoke of France, telling Jefferson that he had considered asking the new vice president to undertake a mission to Paris, but that he supposed it was out of the question, as it did not seem justifiable for him to send away the person destined to take his place in case of accident to himself, nor decent to remove from competition one who was a rival in the public favor. What did Jefferson think of dispatching Madison to join a diplomatic mission in Paris? Jefferson agreed that he should not leave the country and thought Madison would refuse such a post. Adams, however, seemed determined. He said that if Mr. Madison should refuse, he would still appoint him and leave the responsibility on him. The ceremonial proceedings in Congress Hall on Saturday, March 4, 1797, were brief but memorable. Congress gathered for a short session. The business was the inauguration of the president and the vice president and the swearing in of new senators and representatives. The president pro tempore of the Senate, William Bingham of Pennsylvania, administered the oath of office to Jefferson in the second floor Senate chamber. The first American Secretary of State was now the second vice president of the United States. Jefferson, in turn, swore in the 8 new senators and delivered a short speech. He alluded to his broad political convictions and graciously, but unmistakably, to the mortality of the president. No one more sincerely prays that no accident may call me to the higher and more important functions which the Constitution eventually devolves on this office. In a sign of the virulence of the time, some Jefferson supporters found his speech too conciliatory. His first act in the Senate was to make a damn time-serving, trimming speech, in which he declared that it was a great pleasure to him to have an opportunity of serving his country under such a tried patriot as John Adams, which was saying to his friends, "I am in. Kiss my blank and go to hell," one New York Republican was said to have remarked. After Jefferson was done, they reconvened in the House chamber on the ground floor of Congress Hall for the presidential inauguration of John Adams. As Adams recalled it, George Washington seemed cheerful, even relieved. Methinks I heard him say, "I am fairly out and you fairly in. see which of us will be happiest. Jefferson thought Washington a lucky man. The president is fortunate to get off, just as the bubble is bursting, leaving others to hold the bag, he wrote Madison. Privately, Jefferson repeated his claims of satisfaction at the results of the election. The second office of this government is honorable and easy, Jefferson said. The first is but a splendid misery. 2 days after the inauguration, Adams and Jefferson dined with Washington. The new president and vice president left the table together. On the street, Jefferson told Adams that Madison would decline the appointment to France. It was just as well. The new president had spent time with his cabinet that day and found opposition among the Federalists to his thought of sending Madison. He immediately said that on consultation, some objections to that nomination had been raised which he had not contemplated, Jefferson recalled, and was going on with excuses which evidently embarrassed him when we came to Fifth Street where our road separated, his being down Market Street, mine off along Fifth, and we took leave. And he never after that said one word to me on the subject, or ever consulted me as to any measures of the government. John Adams governed amid stress and strain. As president, he fought to keep the peace, or at least a semblance of it, during what became known as the Quasi-War with France. A sustained series of expensive naval engagements, Adams referred to it as the Half-War with France. To see him through his years in office, he retained Washington's cabinet, including the Federalist Secretary of State, Timothy Pickering. This proved problematic, for the cabinet officers tended to see themselves as autonomous, complicating Adams's administration by undercutting the president. And as vice president, Jefferson spent most of his time presiding over the Senate and tending, quietly, to the construction and nurture of the Republican opposition to Adams's Federalist government. Reflecting on the evening conversation with Adams and on the events of Monday, March 6, 1797, Jefferson wrote, "The opinion I formed at the time on this transaction was that Mr. Adams, in the first moments of the enthusiasm of the occasion, his inauguration, forgot party sentiments, and as he never acted on any system but was always governed by the feeling of the moment, he thought for a moment to steer impartially between the parties. That Monday, the 6th of March, being the first time he had met his cabinet, on expressing ideas of this kind, he had been at once diverted from them, and returned to his former party views." The Adams presidential years were busy personal ones in Jefferson's domestic sphere. Patsy Randolph had three children between 1796 and 1801. In 1796, the Duke de la Rochefoucauld called at Monticello, and found that Patsy's younger, beautiful sister Polly constantly resides with her father. But as she is 17 years old and is remarkably handsome, she will doubtless soon find that there are duties which it is sweeter to perform than those of a daughter. The next year, Polly married John Wales Epps, a cousin. They would have two children, and Jefferson himself arrived at Monticello for a visit on Tuesday, July 11, 1797. 8 months and 3 weeks later, Sally Hemings gave birth to a son. The baby was named William Beverly, called Beverly. During the vice presidential years, Jefferson became more philosophical about criticism, seeing it as an inevitable feature of political life, something to be endured, like storm or fire, if one wished to prevail in the public arena. "I've been for some time used as the property of the newspapers, a fair mark for every man's dirt," he wrote. "Some, too, have indulged themselves in this exercise who would not have done it, had they known me otherwise than through these impure and injurious channels. It is hard treatment, and for a singular kind of offense, that of having obtained by the labors of a life the indulgent opinions of a part of one's fellow citizens. However, these moral evils must be submitted to, like the physical scourges of tempest, fire, etc." It was a more mature and measured view than he had held even while in France or at the beginning of his term as Secretary of State, a sign that Jefferson had the capacity to grow and to learn. He did not have to like it, but he knew he had to put up with it. He was thinking along the same lines in terms of partisanship. By the end of the 1790s, he could even be contemptuous of politicians who held themselves above party. A few individuals of no fixed system at all, governed by the panic or the prowess of the moment, flap as the breeze blows against the republican or the aristocratic bodies, and give to the one or the other a preponderance entirely accidental, he wrote Burr in June 1797. The Jefferson political style, though, remained smooth rather than rough, polite rather than confrontational. He was a warrior for the causes in which he believed, but he conducted his battles at a remove, tending to use friends and allies to write and publish and promulgate the messages he thought crucial to the public debate. Part of the reason for his largely genial mien lay in the Virginia culture of grace and hospitality. Another factor was a calculated decision, based on his experience of men and of politics, that direct conflict was unproductive and ineffective. Jefferson articulated this understanding of politics and the management of conflicting interests in a long, thoughtful letter to a grandson. A determination never to do what is wrong, prudence, and good humor will go far toward securing to you the estimation of the world, he wrote to Patsy's son, Thomas Jefferson Randolph. Good humor, Jefferson added, is the practice of sacrificing to those whom we meet in society all the little conveniences and preferences which will gratify them and deprive us of nothing worth a moment's consideration. It is the giving a pleasing and flattering turn to our expressions which will conciliate others and make them pleased with us as well as themselves. How cheap a price for the goodwill of another! Jefferson went on. When this is in return for a rude thing said by another, it brings him to his senses. It mortifies and corrects him in the most salutary way, and places him at the feet of your good nature in the eyes of the company. But in stating prudential rules for our government in society, I must not omit the important one of never entering into dispute or argument with another. I never yet saw an instance of one of two disputants convincing the other by argument. I have seen many, on their getting warm, becoming rude and shooting one another. Conviction is the effect of our own dispassionate reasoning, either in solitude or weighing within ourselves dispassionately what we hear from others, standing uncommitted in argument ourselves. It was one of the rules which, above all others, made Dr. Franklin the most amiable of men in society, never to contradict anybody. The pro-English Jay Treaty had produced a cataclysmic reaction in France. The efforts to keep peace with Britain, in part because of France, now led to fears of war with France because of Britain. Such were the politics of the 1790s. French ships began seizing American craft. I anticipate the burning of our seaports, havoc of our frontiers, household insurgency, with a long train of et ceteras, which it is enough for a man to have met once in his life, Jefferson wrote. The perpetual threat of conflict, first with one European power, then with another, infused American politics with a sense of constant crisis. Both Federalists and Republicans believed the fate of the United States could turn on the confrontation of the hour. In the broad public discourse driven by partisan editors publishing partisan newspapers, there seemed no middle ground, only extremes of opinion or of outcome. Into this culture of entrenched division came the publication of a 1796 letter of Jefferson's that appeared to attack President Washington as a tool of the British interest. It was May 1797 when Philip Matsey publicized the Washington letter Jefferson had written him the year before. It would give you a fever were I to name to you the apostates who have gone over to these heresies, men who were Samsons in the field and Solomons in the council, but who have had their heads shorn by the harlot England, Jefferson had written of the Jay Treaty controversy. In short, we are likely to preserve the liberty we have obtained only by unremitting labors and perils. The letter was taken as a Jeffersonian assault on Washington and the president's allegedly pro-British tendencies, which made it perfect fodder for the Federalist press. The passions are too high at present to be cooled in our day, Jefferson wrote an old friend. About that, at least, both Republicans and Federalists might have agreed, for anecdotes suggesting the other side's extremism and unreasonableness were in substantial supply. The Federalists had Jefferson's Mazzei letter, and the Republicans heard plenty about their enemies, too. On Christmas Day, 1797, Madison repeated worries that Adams was using a new yellow fever epidemic to seize additional power by possibly postponing the meeting of Congress. And word reached Jefferson that Adams, upset at Republican George Clinton's respectable showing in the 1792 balloting for vice president, had said, "Damn 'em, damn 'em. You see that an elective government will not do." And that Adams had reportedly recently remarked that Republicanism must be disgraced, sir. Jefferson was intrigued by similar tales about Hamilton. In late 1797, Tench Coxe alleged that Hamilton had said, "For my part, I avow myself a monarchist. I have no objection to a trial being made of this thing of a republic, but etc." Such stories did little to calm Jefferson's fears about his Federalist colleagues. Chapter 29. The Reign of Witches. "No, I think a party is necessary in a free state to preserve its freedom. The truly virtuous should firmly unite and form a party capable at all times of frustrating the wicked designs of the enemies of the doctrine of equality and the rights of man." Jefferson friend John Page. In the new year, two of Jefferson's housemates at Francis's Tavern, Congressman Abraham Baldwin of Georgia and Thompson J. Skinner of Massachusetts, told Jefferson a disturbing story about 1787. As they described it, a very extensive combination had taken place in New York and the eastern states among people who were partly monarchical in principle or frightened with Shay's rebellion and the impotence of the old Congress. Representatives, Jefferson was informed, had actually had consultations on the subject of seizing on the powers of a government and establishing them by force, had corresponded with one another, and had sent a deputy to General Washington to solicit his cooperation. Washington did not join the plot, and the constitutional convention proposed by Virginia had been called in the meantime. Still, the monarchists, in this account, had been, and were, counting on the failure of the new government. Monarchy would then step into the breach. Jefferson's vice presidency, which ran from 1797 to 1801, unfolded in a fevered climate. One congressman, the Republican Matthew Lyon of Vermont, spat in the face of another, the Federalist Roger Griswold of Connecticut, after Griswold insulted Lyon's courage. An effort to expel Lyon, a ferociously partisan editor, failed. Frustrated, Griswold attacked Lyon with a cane. Fighting back, Lyon seized some fireplace tongs and the two brawled on the House floor. The driving source of national fear was a potential war with France after the Jay Treaty. Then, in March 1798, Adams revealed that a diplomatic mission to France had failed when three French officials, known as X, Y, and Z in state papers, demanded bribes, a huge loan, and an American apology as the price of doing business in the wake of the treaty debacle. The political effect of the episode in the United States was electric. Americans felt insulted by the French, and talk of war intensified. The news of the attempted extortion, Jefferson said, produced such a shock on the Republican mind as has never been seen since our independence. John Adams issued a message calling on Americans to prepare for war. He ordered the country to adopt with promptitude, decision, and unanimity measures to protect our seafaring and commercial citizens, for the defense of any exposed portions of our territory, for replenishing our arsenals, establishing foundries and military manufactures, and to provide such efficient revenue as will be necessary to defray extraordinary expenses and supply the deficiencies which may be occasioned by depredations on our commerce. Such was the quasi-war, a series of naval attacks that pitted the United States against its first and most important ally in a brutal, if undeclared, war. The sulphurous events of the period cast Jefferson in a role for which he was well suited, that of the eloquent champion of individual rights against a John Adams-led campaign to quell dissent in America amid anxieties about French power and French agents. It was not the last time Americans would curb civil liberties for the sake of national security. The main occasion for the tumult in the Adams administration was the four pieces of legislation popularly known as the Alien and Sedition Acts. Passed in reaction to the war climate, the bills invested the president with extraordinary powers at the expense, Republicans argued, of the liberties of a free people. The alien laws collectively invested the president the authority to deport resident aliens he considered dangerous. The sedition bill criminalized free speech, forbidding anyone to write, print, utter, or publish any false, scandalous, and malicious writing or writings against the government of the United States, or either house of the Congress of the United States, with intent to defame or to bring them into contempt or disrepute, or to excite against them, or either or any of them, the hatred of the good people of the United States. So began a furiously divisive time of intensity and vitriol. Jefferson and the Republicans believed they were no longer expecting, but were instead experiencing, the end of American liberty. "Everyone has a right to explain himself," John Taylor wrote, adding that the government was now manufacturing a law which may even make it criminal to pray to God for better times. Some Republicans detected monarchical autocracy at work. John Dickinson, Jefferson's former colleague from the Continental Congress, drew on the history of the English Civil War to illustrate how far he believed President Adams had strayed. "How incredible was it once, and how astonishing is it now, that every measure and every pretense of the stupid and selfish Stuarts should be adopted by the posterity of those who fled from their madness and tyranny to the distant and dangerous wilds of America." Once sedition legislation passed and was signed by Adams, the speaking of one's mind, a foundational freedom, could result in fines up to $2,000 and up to 2 years in prison. "For my own part, I consider these laws as merely an experiment on the American mind to see how far it will bear an avowed violation of the Constitution," Jefferson said. "If this goes down, we shall immediately see attempted another act of Congress declaring that the president shall continue in office during life, reserving to another occasion the transfer of the succession to his heirs and the establishment of the Senate for life." It would, in other words, be the death of what Jefferson's generation had fought for. Adams and the Federalists believed they were limited.